Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Sam Harris is a very thoughtful guy who, boy, we talk about a lot of different things in the second half here, but I think you're going to want to hear this and share it because it's pretty thought-provoking conversation with a very bright guy. First, I'll tell you about Bet Online. Nothing to bet on, right? Wrong. Bet Online has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. They bring Vegas style online poker and blackjack 24/7 right to your home. Miss the NFL? Live daily Madden NFL 20 simulations to wager on. Plus Big Brother, stocks, even the Nathan's hot dog eating competition coming up. And NASCAR's back. Yeah, they're running, baby. Visit the website or use your mobile device to join today. Bet Online, our exclusive partner at Podcast One. Sign up for a free account with promo code Podcast One for your sign up bonus. Visit betonline.ag. Don't forget, use the promo code Podcast One for your sign up bonus today. Bet Online, your online sportsbook experts.
The Adam Carolla Show salutes the winners of the COVID-19 pandemic. Lori Loughlin. After more than a year of maintaining your innocence, you finally pled guilty to one count of conspiracy to commit wire and mail fraud. Your husband did the same thing. This plea deal does come with jail time, but they're releasing real criminals from jail right now, so the chances of you doing actual time are slim to none. So while folks like Felicity Huffman pled guilty early and had to do actual jail time, you will most likely receive a suspended sentence and do some time on house arrest. But your win will only lead to a great media win because they can finally say, full house arrest. Lori Loughlin, we knew you were lying. You knew you were lying. But damn it, kid, you got moxie. And that makes you a winner of COVID-19.
Long but sound, Dawson. Sam Harris has joined us. I'm a fan of his. He's an author, philosopher, neuroscientist as well. Has a podcast, Making Sense with Sam Harris, and new episodes every week on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and a meditation app called Waking Up. I'm very interested in that. I remember one of my first rounds with you was watching you on Bill Maher's show arguing with Ben Affleck, who seemed possessed at the time. Thanks for joining us, Sam.
Oh, sure. It's a pleasure.
I find myself not from the same kind of background that you have academically. I have no academic background. But as I travel through this thing called life, I find myself thinking more and more about some of the thoughts that you think quite a bit about. Is this something that was always interesting for you, this philosophy and neuroscience, or was it something you kind of came on to?
I kind of did everything backwards. I would say I got into esoteric things first, like meditation and interest in the nature of consciousness and interest in religion, actually, early on. And then it was only after that that I got interested in science and kind of I got into writing and writing what became philosophy. And then I discovered that I really needed to go do some more academic work to do that well. And I was going to do a PhD in philosophy, but then at the last minute decided that it made more sense to do a PhD in neuroscience just to be more in touch with what we were learning about the brain. If I wanted to talk about the mind, I needed to know something about the brain. So it's not the usual order of things, but it's I'm now in a position happily to really get all of my intellectual interests on the same page. I mean, it's all kind of converged. And so now I think a lot about the nature of the human mind and what constitutes a good life. And so there's moral philosophy combined with neuroscience, combined with public policy and even politics. So it all is kind of gelling. And I don't, as you probably know, I don't really respect the boundaries between disciplines very much. I don't think reality is following the architectural plan of a university. So I think you can think profitably about really anything that interests you and just go back and forth across the the boundaries between disciplines.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, have a variety of people you listen to and from all sides of the aisle and spectrum, and then just sort of cherry pick all the best of, like some kind of jukebox where you just play your favorite songs. I've been talking to Dr. Drew about this a lot, especially during this pandemic, and people and adults especially sort of losing their ability to reason and use logic in a world where everything's captured on videotape and every fact is provable using your phone or your computer. How far away we're getting away from the truth? Is that it's not making sense to me. I thought by now we'd all be sort of securely moored to the truth because we have videotape and we have phones and we have computers and it's all so readily available, but it feels like we're getting further away from a reality into everyone sort of creating their own form of reality. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, it really is cutting both ways what technology is doing to us. This is something rather like a psychological experiment that we've all been enrolled in without really consenting to it. And the outcome is not at all obvious, but you take the impact of social media and the internet generally and the instantaneous access to information and an ability to communicate with everyone potentially, and to have your communication not only go one-to-one with anyone, but to have a larger and larger audience. And so people begin to signal to an audience and to their tribe within that audience. And this is distorting communication. It's distorting people's thinking about the world, and it's improving it in some places. I mean, you can fact check something very easily, or certainly more easily than you used to be able to, but you can also silo yourself off into an echo chamber, really just curated by your own delusions, your preferred delusions. And so people, it used to be that, to become a real crackpot, you had to work hard to find, either you did it in solitude or you had to work pretty hard to find other crackpots. And when you met them at the crackpot conference, they rather often looked like crackpots, right? You could see the dysfunction in their lives. And, they would advertise to you, both their mania and their really lack of credibility on many topics. But now, you don't know who you're getting information from, and it could be some 18-year-old in the proverbial mother's basement just blogging about whatever it is, 9/11 truth or something that some rabbit hole you've gone down, and you can spend a decade down that hole not recognizing who you're dealing with or whether it's Russian bots or whoever getting information into your head. So it does cut both ways. I mean, I'm bullish on the prospect of communication generally. I think if we can just continue the conversation long enough, we converge more and more on truth. But you do need some basic principles by which to do that. And one is you have to be alert to confirmation bias in your case. You have to be alert to just seeking out, and this is everyone's tendency, to seek out confirmation of your cherished opinion and to ignore disconfirmations. And if you're just looking for reasons why it's possible to believe something rather than looking for the reason, the things that actually disconfirm your view, you can always find reasons why it's possible to believe something, because it's rare to have a view, even a crazy one, completely knocked down for all time by specific facts. So it's, we have to become more intelligent consumers of information.
I'll just sort of leap from topic to topic. I have been telling people for a while now that we're going to need to sort of take charge of our mental hygiene a little better than we've been doing in the past. And the physical part we got, you're no longer working, chopping, swinging an axe all day. You're not working at a sawmill. You're not up on your feet. You're not carrying a gourd with water in it on your head. So we invented a treadmill. You go run on that. And you can strap on a weighted vest to simulate the logs you would be carrying back to the campsite. So we kind of physically figured out you need to simulate this, you know, indoor rock climbing walls and stuff like that, you know, just an indoor mountain that we simulate climbing a mountain. And actually, we got it. I don't feel like we anticipated the mental part of this. It's invisible. You know, you see yourself putting weight on. You see it. You don't see yourself getting crazy. And go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very important distinction. The invisibility of the mind and the lack of social proof for change. I mean, so as you say, you know, physical training is a thing, and we've understood that for, you know, at least a century, but it used to be a completely esoteric thing, right? So 150 years ago, the only person engaged in real physical training was that freak at the circus, you know, with the handlebar mustache, right? It was just not, it made no sense to be living that way. And you can imagine, you could sort of reclaim some of that, you know, early astonishment if you just think of how strange physical exercise looks from the outside if you don't understand the project. I mean, if you look at somebody just picking up random heavy objects and putting them down over and over again, it's bizarre, but you know, the results are there for all to see. Now, it is a fact, as you say, that mental training now is just as esoteric as physical exercise was, you know, over a century ago, and yet it is a thing. I mean, the mind is, you know, on some basic level, what the brain is doing. And most people have this notion that mental growth stops in adulthood. You know, they understand you can learn new things, but your mind itself doesn't fundamentally improve. You can't actually become a better person, a kinder person, a more compassionate person, a more deeply wise person. You can't transform your personality. And that, basically, that's untrue. It's hard, and the fact that it's hard makes it difficult to see just how far a person can take this project. And there are ways to see the possibility. I mean, many of us didn't discover the benefit of things like meditation until we first took psychedelics. And in my case, that honestly was a necessary piece. I mean, if I had not taken MDMA the first time, I would not have understood that my mind could be a much better place to live in than it was tending to be. And I wouldn't have sought out meditation as a practice. And even if I had sought it out, I think had I not seen how much greener the grass was on the other side of that fence, I probably wouldn't have even seen the fence, right? And because it took some significant training before I started to really experience the benefits. But You can, in the same way that you can with physical exercise, you can transform your moment-to-moment experience of the world. And the importance of doing that is it's just a basic recognition that you're in each moment, your mind is all you have, right? And the quality of your mind determines the quality of your life and the quality of your relationships. And you know, everything else you find captivating at the level of your attention, the goals to which you aspire, and the way you feel about the past and the degree to which you worry about the future. All of these are mental events, and your relationship to your thoughts and moods and emotions can be fundamentally changed. And it takes some work to do that, but it's certainly worth doing.
Well, the thought that was coming to my mind as you were saying that, and I had an experience the first time I took mushrooms when I was like 19 or 20, which is, I'm not a psychedelic guy per se. I've had taken mushrooms a few times, but I remember thinking, oh, I'm now thinking differently than what I was sort of indoctrinated to think. And what I mean is I remember getting high on mushrooms, and I was watching TV, and a commercial came on for Lee press-on nails, plastic red nails women would stick to the end of their fingers. And I thought,
that's exactly what you want to watch on mushrooms.
I remember thinking, now, if I wasn't high, it would just be the 5,700th time I saw a commercial for Lee press-on nails. But now that I'm high, I'm examining this world that we've created, this society that we've created, where the females of the species are sticking these bloody red extensions, essentially making claws. And I remember thinking when I was high, oh, you would have never had these thoughts. You wouldn't have examined it and looked at it this way. You wouldn't have sort of taken this approach to what you're looking at. You would have just seen it, had another swig off your beer, and moved on. And so I always kind of recognize the value of removing yourself sort of from how you think, how society thinks. You're right in the middle of it. You know, it's hard to get away from it. This was getting away from it in my mind. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. There are really two different aspects to this. I mean, one is you can change the contents of consciousness. You can have new ideas. You can think in different patterns, and all of that's worth doing because, you know, the contents of our minds so often are a matter of this really dismal conversation we tend to have with ourselves, and we're just judging ourselves, and we're worrying about the future, and we're replaying conversations we had with somebody in our heads, and we're judging everyone else, and we're just, there's a kind of mediocrity. And I mean, honestly, if you could just externalize your thoughts, you would notice that you're telling yourself the same story over and over again, and you've lost your capacity to be bored. I mean, you're like the perfect audience for the most boring person in the world. I'm speaking not of you personally, but really everyone who practices meditation. You just notice how repetitive these patterns are, and so you can improve all that by shaking things up in a variety of ways. Just having better conversations with people who know things you don't, and learning new skills, and reading good books, and all we do all of that, and that's worth doing. And perturbing the brain with psychedelics or marijuana or some drug like that. I mean, obviously not all drugs are the same. But some clearly kick open the door to new levels of creativity and just connecting up, you know, perceptions and ideas in ways that are novel. And so there's a whole poetic engagement with reality that can get, jump-started there, and it's, you know, that's worth doing. But the core goal of meditation is to change one's relationship with the contents of consciousness entirely, so that on some level it doesn't matter what the thoughts are or what the emotions are. You want to recognize things as mere appearances in this prior space of that's knowing things, which, you know, for consciousness or awareness, for lack of a better word. And that's that transition from being lost in thought perpetually to recognizing thoughts of you know, whatever they are. I mean, it could be beautifully insightful thoughts or the most boring thought you've had all day. Just noticing these bits of language or images in the mind as appearances, that breaks a spell which is really the core of our psychological suffering. I mean, we spend all day feeling like there's a subject in our heads, right? That we're kind of riding around in the body like a passenger. We don't feel identical to our bodies. We feel like we have bodies, and we feel like the subject. And that sense of being the thinker of thoughts or the experiencer of experience, there's something in the center of experience that's not merely identical to experience, but just it's having the experience. That feeling of I, that's what it feels like to be thinking without vividly recognizing thoughts as appearances in consciousness. And so meditation, the real purpose of meditation is to have that recognition. And then there's something very interesting happens. You begin to feel a kind of well-being that is not predicated on anything changing or anything happening. It's like, it's just the inherent tranquility of consciousness is a thing you're noticing. And then then, it, you know, in that moment, it doesn't matter that, you know, the last thought that came through your mind was an angry one, or the pain in your knee has not gone away, or, you know, it's just your well-being is not contingent upon changing the contents of consciousness in the next moment.
Well, let's talk about change. I realize I had this thought that I don't think I've ever had before. I know that we fight change, you know, we're constantly fighting change. And I know personally, you know, if somebody says, hey, you could probably be a better parent if you did X, Y, and Z, I immediately go, what do you mean? I do blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm already kind of pushing back, you know, instead of absorbing it and going, okay, I think I'm a good parent, but I could be better. So I'll do that. I do that reaction of I do this and I do that, and everyone's kind of pushing back against change. But also I've realized probably built the whole society against that. I mean, or to help perpetuate that. I have this sort of thought that Madison Avenue and companies and society figures out pretty quickly what works, what our capacities and propensities are, what we want to do. So if we're fear-based, and then you turn on the news and it's the new death toll hits a macabre plateau at almost 80,000, you know, and it's like, okay, they're selling pancakes to us. They know what we do and they're giving it to us. You know what I'm saying? And so our society and our culture is basically built itself around this us not wanting to change. You know, it's like, well, you got to sell them this brand of toothpaste when they're 15 because they'll use it for the rest of their life. You know, they won't change, or you got to get them on this brand of cigarettes at 15 or whatever it is. And I'm realizing that we should be changing, and everything is kind of conspiring against us changing, except for folks like you who are sort of outliers saying, do this differently, although that is a growing population. But change in our society, do you have thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are certain kinds of changes we want. I mean, obviously, most people have a model of ways they want their lives to change. They have a list of things they want, whether they're career goals or relationship goals, or they want to improve their health. And people want change, but they want control, right? They want to be able to move in an orderly way from where they are to where they want to be. And it just so happens we're living in a system, and we're a part of that system. I mean, our minds and brains are our systems themselves, where control is basically an illusion, right? We don't have control ultimately over anything. I mean, we have a pretense of control in certain ways. I mean, you can tend to be who you were yesterday, and most of us will tend to do that. But you didn't invent yourself. You didn't pick your genes or your parents or the conditions in which you grew up. You haven't made your mind, and every choice you're making now is based on all of these, you know, these patterns of conditioning that, you know, precede you as the conscious subject of your life. And so you have exactly the level of effort and ambition that you have today and not an ounce more. And if somebody has a conversation with you and really inspires you to do better or to work harder, well, then, you know, that's great. That's an influence that can have its effect, but you didn't pick how that influenced you and to what degree it did, right? So it's on some level, everything is just happening, right? And we also know that anything at any point can happen. I mean, this you know, coronavirus pandemic, for all its other effects, and one thing it teaches us is that life can change for everyone very, very quickly and emphatically, and in a way that no one really foresaw. I mean, this was totally foreseeable, but it wasn't foreseeable to happen, you know, in the month of February. And so suddenly, like, we're part of history, right? I mean, many of us, you know, you and I are pretty close to the same age. You know, I didn't really feel like I was part of history until 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. Before 9/11, I felt like basically, you know, the history was one thing. History is something you read about in history books, but we're living in a time of real order, and we're not going to be fundamentally surprised by the direction that civilization takes. And then people start flying planes into our buildings, and all of a sudden we have a decade that is filled with multi-trillion dollar wars and bizarre concerns about, you know, theocracy in the Middle East and terrorism. And this pandemic is another one of those things where it just comes lurching out of the shadows, and you realize, well, there is nothing guaranteeing anything good here apart from human ingenuity and the capacity to cooperate. I mean, what we need to maintain above all else, and this is why, you know, the pollution of our information space is so toxic, we need to maintain an ability for nearly 8 billion people, 8 billion strangers to cooperate with one another peacefully. I mean, that's the only thing that guarantees that this project is open-ended. And we, you know, we have problems, massive problems we have to solve, and many of them only admit of you know, global solutions at this point. And, you know, a pandemic, you know, response, an intelligent response to a pandemic is certainly one of those things, as is an intelligent response to a, you know, an economic catastrophe that follows our response to the pandemic. So there's just, on some level, it's really humbling how minimal the tools are we have here to with which to do anything. I mean, and the most basic tool is honest conversation among people who are willing to be motivated, have appropriate emotional responses to a common set of facts. And if we can't acknowledge, you know, the same part of terrestrial reality and admit that facts are facts, or if we have, you know, if we have whole subsets of humanity who have completely deranged emotional responses to the same facts because they have, you know, insane beliefs about, you know, paradise and the afterlife and martyrdom, or what, you know, to take one example, it just, conversation and cooperation becomes impossible. And, you know, we keep witnessing the warp and woof of that, you know, hour by hour in our world. And it's really on some levels, the only thing going on. It's like, can we cooperate and expand human knowledge in useful ways, or is cooperation going to break down for, you know, reasons of just an impossibility of communication?
Well, and I should clarify myself, because we love the subject of change. We just don't personally like it. It's like we like prisons, just sort of not in our backyard. Hope and change, you know, we're 3 days away from fundamentally changing this society. Like, we like that kind of change, but we don't like engaging in it. But maybe that's a weird thing, that we like talking about it and hearing about it a lot, but we don't do it personally that much. And yeah, facts. I am very, very attracted to facts, and they seem so accessible now. And so it almost seems like the people who the facts don't help are waging a more strident war against facts. Like I just sort of that whole conversation with you on Real Time with Ben and Bill was you and Bill trying to push some facts, and not in a radical way, just pushing some facts out ahead and fighting people that were wrestling with the facts, even though they didn't need to. There was a conversation that could have been had.
Right. Yeah. Well, in that case, you know, when conversation is breaking down, it's useful to look at the assumptions people have, because they're often implicit. They're not necessarily expressed in the conversation. And, you know, it's the problem with normal television, you know, unlike a podcast, is the time pressure makes conversation so often impossible. I mean, everyone's just struggling to get a word in edgewise, and interruptions really threaten, you know, that you'll be taken out of context or just unable to say what you need to say. Whereas on a podcast, you can really let the conversation breathe. And that's why podcasting is enjoying such a boom. But there, you know, one assumption is that, you know, all religions are at bottom the same, and they teach the same thing, and they teach it equally well. And, you know, they can all get hijacked by extremists and perverted, but at bottom, they're all teaching love and compassion and respect for the individual. And you know, these are good messages, and they're equivalent. Now, that's just not true, right? Even if where they do seem to teach the same thing, they don't teach it equally well. Worse, when you get to their serious doctrines, you know, which true believers have to believe in order to be in good standing in that faith community, they're mutually exclusive. You know, if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that is blasphemy within Islam, right? So it's just a deal breaker. It's like it offers about as much compromise as a coin toss, right? So the true fundamentalists in each religion understand that there's no reconciling their most cherished beliefs. And it's only the moderates, or the people who have kind of lost their purchase on their faith, who can engage in a truly open-ended interfaith dialogue that seems to promise some meeting of the minds. I mean, moderation is definitely better than fundamentalism. I think moderation is great, except it's often quite dishonest, because it doesn't acknowledge how it became moderate. And you certainly don't become moderate by reading the books more closely. You know, God is not a moderate, and there's no place in the Bible where moderation is recommended. And so anyway, so, you know, the one assumption that Batman was laboring under there was that only bigotry could explain a specific concern about Islam. If you're a white guy who's more worried about Islam in the aftermath of 9/11 than you are about Mormonism or Anglicanism or even Scientology, the only way to be more worried about Islam there is to be a racist or a bigot. And that's just untrue. You know, and what Ben needs is to get in conversation with some ex-Muslims or some moderate Muslims, you know, real moderate Muslims. He'll hear the same concerns from them that I was voicing in that conversation. And, you know, he won't be so confused by the color of the person's skin or their country of origin. You know?
Well, I can't figure out. And I think Christopher Hitchens is a guy you enjoy, correct?
Yeah, he was a friend, yeah.
And I was watching him talking, having a debate on the 92nd Y, I believe it was. And he was talking about Islam. And at some point he just said, the things that I'm saying about Islam, I can say here, but I couldn't say them in parts of Europe and many parts of the world, because I would fear what would happen to me as I left the auditorium. Or I'm paraphrasing, but you know what I'm saying. And to me, that's sort of an ultimate truth. You know, if in fact you have a Charlie Hebdo, or I'm trying to think of the newspaper that printed the
thing. Charlie Hebdo. Yeah.
Hebdo, right.
The Danish cartoon controversy before that. Yeah.
Right. Now, you can tell me all you want about the history of Christianity and Mormons and Judaism or what have you. You can tell me all about the Crusades, but I would not print that cartoon that was printed in that newspaper for fear that something could happen. And Christopher, I voiced the same thing. And you can look at all the statistics you want, but to me, that's a bigger truth. That's a real world truth. And Ben Affleck can say there, you know, the amount of people that would do anything to him or them at the newspaper or whatever, it's minuscule. You could say all you want, but don't we all share that truth and have that feeling? And if so, why do we have that feeling?
Well, there's no argument against that. I mean, that's actually a point I made to Ben as we left the table. So it was off air, but this is something as we're walking back to the green room, this is precisely the point I made, which is, you're acting like there's no difference between these religions, but you know that if we had decided to burn a Book of Mormon here on air tonight, people would have been pissed off. We would have gotten hate mail. But it would have ended there. Had we burned a copy of the Quran on this show tonight, everyone on this panel would spend the rest of their lives dealing with those consequences, right? And the consequences wouldn't have been local. You burn a Quran on HBO, I guarantee you, and certainly at that point, there would have been riots by people by the tens of thousands would have rioted in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I mean, scores of people would have died over that. No question. You could bet your life on it. And that is a difference you can make sense of it in terms of the theology. It's not an accident that difference exists, but on some level, it's potentially true of other religions too. I mean, it was certainly true of Christianity in the 14th century. It's on some level, you can say that Islam is where Christianity was a long time ago. And so it's just out of step with modernity in a way that other religions aren't. And that's a huge difference, right? And it has to be aligned with modernity to the point where you can actually criticize ideas without fear of being hunted by theocrats for the rest of your life. And there are people, I have friends who are being hunted by theocrats for the rest of their lives for things they have written or said about Islam, and, where it's not safe for them to travel to certain countries, and they have to get security wherever they go, even in this one. I mean, that's the amazing thing, is that even in the States, we're not aware of having given up our First Amendment rights on this particular topic. I mean, we're aware of it at the margins. I mean, when South Park has to put Muhammad in a bear suit, and so you only see a bear in the cartoon, and then even that isn't sufficient, they get death threats and they have to take that episode off of Comedy Central, as they did at the time. People don't really score that as a major societal cost, but we're practicing, we've been practicing massive self-censorship on this topic for decades now. Ever since Salman Rushdie published the Satanic Verses in 89, and half the liberal intelligentsia blamed him for having defamed a great faith. And blamed him for the death threats and for the decade he had to spend in hiding. We just have never reclaimed the ground of real equality here. And real equality is, you should be able to stage a Broadway play making fun of Mormonism, and what happens is the Mormons take out ads in Playbill for their religion, right? That's just a completely good-spirited retort to your happy artwork. Whereas we know that if there had been a Broadway production making fun of Islam, it's impossible. No one would stage it, and there'd be bomb threats for every performance. I mean, there certainly would have been at the time the Book of Mormon came out. And so, I mean, this is not a problem anyone's paying attention to now, given
right.
COVID and our other political concerns. But it's not. This problem has also not gone away. I mean, I think we'll be living with the heightened concerns about jihadism. Ultimately, I mean, the most doctrinaire form of fundamentalist Islam, and that is a generational thing that we still have to unwind, and we just have to speak honestly about it.
Well, I mean, I remember after Benghazi, we were blaming the cartoonist who made a cartoon, offensive cartoon.
Right.
Now, when somebody sets an embassy on fire and burns people alive, the notion of having the cartoonist, getting them in your crosshairs and your ire toward the cartoonist, means we're horribly misguided. We're missing the point. And I would say intentionally missing the point.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you can sort of see the source code running in the background here. The reason why, and this is what was confounding Ben's side of the conversation, there's this notion that, again, concerns about racism and colonialism sneak in here. And it's a logical error because, first of all, Islam, you know, is not a race, right? Islam is a set of ideas, and Muslims can come from any race. You know, a person can convert to Islam in 5 minutes, and now they are a Muslim as long as they profess to believe certain ideas. And so this is, you know, and any comparison between Islam and another religion that with which it's in conflict rather often, like Hinduism, right, has you know, people in this case, India, you know, who look Indian because they are Indian on both sides of that equation. So racism has absolutely nothing to do with this, right? And any, you know, so, but he couldn't quite see that, right? So he kept calling us racist.
I'm not sure. I have a bunch of thoughts. I'm not sure if people who are calling people like you and sometimes me racist think we're racist. I'm not exactly convinced that's what they think.
If they're lazy, they might think that because there are real racists in the world who would certainly echo some of these same thoughts. Like there are real racists who don't want any more immigration, not for all the rational reasons you might be concerned about immigration, but they just don't like, you know, more brown-skinned people from other cultures on their streets, right? And so if you ask those people about what do you think about Islam, well, they'll have some uncharitable things to say about Islam. And if I'm saying uncharitable things about Islam, I can sound like I'm echoing those people. So I can see the possibility of confusion there, but you just have to, I mean, if you hear what I also say about white supremacists and white nationalists and even fundamentalist Christians, it should be obvious within about 15 seconds that concerns about race have absolutely nothing to do with my concern about Islam. And it makes no sense because, you know, if anything, my argument applies even more to a white convert to Islam from, you know, like someone like John Walker Lind, you know, the so-called American Taliban, or Adam Gadon, the guy from Orange County who joined Al Qaeda. I mean, these are guys who had every opportunity to get their head straight in you know, with 21st century Enlightenment values, and they still found their way down the rabbit hole of jihadism. And so it's. Just race is just not a variable here, but I do think some people are genuinely confused, and then some people are maliciously gaming, you know, or leveraging that confusion because they know it works. I mean, the thing that was so startling about that collision with Ben on Bill's show is that I learned that if you simply call someone a racist, fully half the people in the audience will think that person was exposed as a racist. Mm-hmm. So you simply have to say you're a racist, and 50% of people leave summarizing that conversation thinking, "Oh my God, did you see how he exposed that racism? You know, we're just there in real time. We just saw that racism just leak out of that guy." It's amazing. It's such a charged concept on the left, especially that, you know, I mean, the mere allegation. I mean, it works, I'm sure, for sexism and a few other isms, but it is a winning move for, you know, the people who are filtering by that concern above all others. And it's, you know, it's the problem with the whole wokeness mind virus. It's not that concerns about racism are invalid. Racism is a real problem. It's a diminishing problem, happily. I mean, the idea that we're living, you know, in 2020, exactly where we were, you know, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, or, you know, struggling to be passed. That's just fundamentally not true. But it's not like it's not a valid concern. But it's in the minds of many people on the far left, it is certainly an exaggerated concern. And their racism detectors are so, you know, poorly calibrated that they find it everywhere. You know, just everything is filtered against that, the color of people's skin.
I have a thought, which obviously seeing everything through the color of everyone's skin, you know, I just heard Michael Moore on the aforementioned Real Time show from last week. And he was like, every time he opens his mouth, he's like, you know, in Michigan, we have a black DA and a black a governor and a black female mayor, not a bunch of white dudes. And it's like, I'm realizing, do you know what that sounds like, that you're constantly harping on the color of people's skin? And it's also weird to have middle-aged white guy talking to middle-aged white guy, cheering on the fact that there's not a middle-aged white guy who's the attorney general of this city or that state. It seems like they would be more self-aware of what they sounded like. It seems weird to me that they're constantly bringing it up. Oh, he is?
He is aware, but his audience, you're not the audience. The audience is of the fellow woke, because that is it. You know, this phrase virtue signaling, which, you know, unfortunately was a good phrase that meant something worth picking out, but now it's this way of slamming people on social media. But there is there's talk to the tribe, and it is a kind of performance, and obviously, this can't be the end game for a civilization that gets over racism. I mean, if we get to a future, then the sort of future that Martin Luther King Jr. envisioned, where people are valued for the content of their character, it's not because we will have followed this to its logical conclusion and just endlessly done arithmetic based on skin color in every circumstance. No, we'll just cease to care about skin color, right? We won't be taking greater tallies of it and becoming more and more fair across any way you can, you know, slice and dice the pie. You're not going to walk into a hospital and find out exactly how many cardiologists are from Pakistan, or there are too many Jews. You know, I mean, it's just that is clearly a moral dead end. We'll just get to a place where skin color is analogous to hair color. I mean, it would never occur to you to wonder how many cardiologists are blonde versus, you know, brunette, right? And, or, you know, whether the mayor, you know, how long has it been since we've had a blonde mayor? It would never occur to you. And so a post-racial society would be one where we've gotten over this fixation and we simply cease to care about the color of a person's skin. And, you know, that if that's the end game and we recognize we're not there yet, the question is, how do we get there? And the far left, and, you know, Michael Moore is, I don't know him personally, but he certainly seems to be, you know, somewhere left of me and somewhere near the edge of the cliff there. The far left seems to think that the way there is to care more and more and more about race. Right.
Right.
And it's just, that is just a, you know, obviously, it obviously can't be true unless they have some story about why we will reach some tipping point and then magically cease to care, you know, on some happy Wednesday. And I just don't see that happening.
I'm going to tease this because I got to take a quick break, but yeah, how do we simultaneously care and talk more about race? And then there was the sort of insane proclamation that it's time we had an honest dialogue about race that these people never want to engage in. But I'll tease this question because I had a theory, which is, as President Obama was nearing the end of his second term, the folks like Michael Moore, who sort of make a business finding issues and racism, realized they had to ratchet up their game, realized that they had to look, get a finer jeweler's loop out to find more racism because we have a black president who just got elected for a second term. So we actually went into overtime versus what I sort of recall in the late 90s or mid 90s, which is little to no conversations about it. But we'll see if, what you think on that. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back with Sam Harris right after this.
Adam's new audiobook is done, and it's fantastically unapologetic.
I'm starting with a warning. I'm not going to apologize for anything in this book. I'm not going to qualify anything in this book. If you don't like something in this book, you can kiss my hairy ass.
I'm your emotional support animal, navigating our all-woke, no-joke culture. Written and narrated by Adam Carolla. Pre-order it now at adamcarolla.com.
Sam Harris is staying with us, Making Sense with Sam Harris, name of the podcast. Every week, new episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the meditation app, Waking Up. So my feeling is this sort of business of race hustling as we move further and further away from the actual racism that we sort of recall from the past, folks are now having to work harder to find it. Does that make sense to you, Sam?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no question that the forms of racism that people imagine they've discovered, they get subtler and subtler, and that's as it should be. I mean, that's what it would look like to make progress on issues of race. And, you know, again, I'm not denying that there's more progress to be made, but let's acknowledge the progress. Many people who are the people who pretend to be finding racism everywhere are acting like this is the worst of all times with respect to race. Like, you know, having had a two-term black president meant nothing, right? That was just, you know, symbolic. And now, you know, things have gotten worse. And, you know, it's easy to see their concern in Trump. I mean, this is why the miscalibration here is so consequential. Because, you know, as you probably know, I'm no fan of the president's, and I have almost nothing good to say about him. But what I will say is that many of the charges against him that come from the left on things like, you know, racism, are so poorly targeted that they're false, and, you know, or they would find racists in other contexts who are clearly not racists or, you know, not motivated by racism. And I say this really having no doubt that Trump is a racist. You know, I do believe I know enough about the man to say that, but it's just, you have to be precise in making specific allegations. And the left is so hysterical on this topic that, you know, precision is almost never what you're meeting here. And so we have to acknowledge the progress we've made and the progress we want to yet make, and the principle by which we would make progress. And again, the principle would be to treat people as individuals and to care less and less about race. Right. I
mean, I find this. So, Dave Rubin said something that just kind of stuck in my head when he was, I think, working for the Young Turks. And he was very, very liberal and very leftist. And he, at some point, he just said he had this realization, which is, how could everyone who disagrees with us be a racist? How would that work? Like, how's it mathematically possible that people disagree with us on every spectrum of every discussion politically? How come they're all racist? And what are the chances? You know what I mean? And basically had an epiphany, which is, we can't just call everyone who disagrees with us or this policy or this political idea a racist. And I'm wondering if you play that racist card too often, if it starts falling on deaf ears.
Well, it definitely does. And that's a disservice to everyone who comes up against a real instance of racism and is justifiably outraged over it, right? I mean, it's the same thing with, you know, sex crimes. If you call everything rape, right? If a bad joke is also a version of rape, or a, you know, a glance, you know, an awkward glance, or
even a,
you know,
hand on the thigh at a club.
Right. You know,
that's
yeah.
Not, I mean, everything is an assault. Right.
Yeah. And any, I mean, there are gradations of assault, right? I mean, not every sexual assault should be called rape either. So
right.
if we can't be precise about what we're talking about, then it devalues the real victims of real injustice. And yeah, so I mean the paradox here, or the pseudo paradox, is I think it's true to say that all the racists are on one side politically, or at least all the racists of the usual sort, right? All the white supremacists, you know, none of them were going to vote for Hillary Clinton, and any of them who would vote would probably have voted for Trump. But that doesn't mean that all the people who voted for Trump are racist, right? And that's, you know, but that may be too much to parse for it when someone simply wants to have a single reason why our society is so politically divided.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Well, I think it could be parsed if somebody wanted to burn the calories, but I don't think they wanted to burn the calories. So you're saying to Ben Affleck, hey, not all Muslims are nowhere near all Muslims are violent or would engage in violent behavior, but a percentage of them are, and that's a big enough percentage to be dangerous, or I'm paraphrasing. And Ben Affleck is saying to you, just because there's a handful of extremists out there doesn't make that group those people, essentially. But he then, the next day, would probably say all Trump supporters are racist, even though it's the same math.
Right.
In a weird way, he would be a hypocrite, because he would say that to you about Muslims and then make the exact same argument against himself, although unknowingly, about Trump supporters.
Yeah, well, the hypocrisy here is pretty amazing, because you're talking about people who think they care about, let's say, you know, women's rights and equality, but political equality and, you know, equality of opportunity between the sexes. But they're totally sanguine about the compulsory veiling of, you know, half the women in these Muslim societies, and the, you know, their forced illiteracy in many of these societies, and the idea that you would criticize this behavior as a advocate for women never occurs to people on the left. I mean, the only way to criticize women in burqas in Afghanistan is to be insensitive to the norms of an ancient culture that doesn't want any of your colonial racist bullshit. And that double standard should be obvious, right? To be born a girl in Afghanistan is to be born unlucky, right? That is obvious. And if I sent my daughters over to Afghanistan for a multi-year internship with the Taliban, where they were forced to live in cloth bags, I would be a bad father, right? So that is something that we can recognize, and we should. I mean, not all cultures have an equal purchase on the basics of human happiness and the norms that allow us to create a society of greater and greater political equality. And we barely have secured those norms ourselves, right? So we can see the direction to go, you know, towards the daylight. And it is in giving people, you know, all the opportunity they can use, and in overcoming our tribalism, right? And what's so deranged about the, you know, the far sides of the political spectrum, left and right now, is that it's a kind of tribalism that makes conversation impossible, right? I mean, we know what the end goal needs to be here. We need to be worthy of all the freedom we can handle, right? And we want government to intrude as little as possible, but to be truly effective where we need it. And technology is changing the story in impressive ways. I mean, one of the reasons why it's not irrational to worry about tiny numbers of people who believe crazy things, or comparatively tiny numbers of people who believe crazy things, is that it's, you know, with the power of our technology, it's becoming easier and easier for small numbers of people to screw up the world for everyone else, right? I mean, 100 right. years ago, you know, 15 people could not have brought down a society. Now we're getting to a place where 15 people could do that, whether you're talking about biological weapons. I mean, look, we're all hunkered down in the middle of a global pandemic, losing trillions and trillions of dollars in the face of a comparatively minor virus,
right?
I mean, this virus could be so much worse, right? I'm not saying that the lockdown is irrational. In fact, I don't think it has been. I think it, you know, we should have done it more emphatically and more effectively, but you know, it makes sense to me. But I just imagine what a better weaponized version of a
virus, yeah.
No, a highly, a virus that spreads like measles, but is, you know, 10 times more lethal than measles. I mean, that shuts down the world, and that very soon is within reach of, you know, honestly, high school students to weaponize. And so we will be tempted to create far more intrusive governments in the face of these technological advances in the fairly near future. And we need thoughtful conversation about all of that. And we will need to figure out what to do in the face of, you know, truly crazy beliefs where, you know, people think that you get everything you want after you die, and there's no reason to continue the human project one more minute, right? That's if you get desktop printing of DNA sequences married to that kind of otherworldliness, you have a terrible problem on your hands, and we know this is coming, right? And we're spending our time, you know, with the woke on one side and the people in Trumpistan on the other arguing about nonsense. And what we need is, you know, intelligent collaboration on, you know, the 10 most pressing problems that we face. And that's, you know, it's the dysfunction in our politics that's making that impossible.
I agree. There's a thought that keeps sort of popping into my head that I'd love to bounce off you. And yes, just to circle back to the folks that are constantly lecturing us about women and women's rights and oppression and so on and so forth, having then no thoughts about Islam and their oppression of women. That to me says maybe they're not as concerned with women's rights as maybe they'd initially spouted off about. But I feel the same way. But, you know, there's a thought that I keep thinking, which is it's illegal to punch anybody in the face in this country. And theoretically, we should be able to talk shit about Mike Tyson the same way we wanted to talk shit about Seth Green, the diminutive actor from The Family Guy and beyond. But we still go, I'm not going to talk shit about Mike Tyson because I think if I saw him, he might punch me. And I don't want to be punched by Mike Tyson. And I feel like we kind of do that with Islam. We go, this is America. We have rights. We say what we want. We have freedom of everything. But we kind of go, I could get punched by Islam and I'm going to bite my lip. And so if I go on TV, I'm going to choose the Ben Affleck posture more than the Sam Harris posture. Like, how much of it is just a pure reptilian brain, this guy may punch me?
Well, yeah, it's certainly a factor, and it's a much greater factor in Muslim majority countries, right? So if you live in Bangladesh or Pakistan, or, I mean, you know, there are blasphemy laws, and, you know, there are atheist bloggers who get, you know, hunted down and killed in front of their families in these countries, just not even for being especially critical of Islam, just just declaring their unbelief, their change of heart about God, right? I mean, it's a killing offense in under Islam and in at least, I think now 12 countries based on their actual laws and the enforced laws to lose your faith, right? And to convert to another faith or to convert to none. And so there's quite literally no freedom of thought there. And it as it was in the 14th century under Christendom, right? So we were burning heretics alive on street corners in cities like Paris and London, and we did that for a good long while before we realized we wanted the kind of human life you can only get when you stop burning people alive for thought crimes. I mean, we wanted better, a more creative, less stressful set of political norms. And we were right to want those things. And ultimately, the Muslim world will need to want those things. And they'll need to relax their standards of adherence to ancient books written by fairly ignorant people, right? And that's as has happened among Jews and Christians for the most part. And it's, that's progress. But it's just worth recognizing what that progress consists of. It consists of taking the contents of these books less and less seriously. You know, when you can see that God wants you to kill your neighbor if you catch him working on the Sabbath, you pretend God didn't say that, or you don't read Leviticus for more than once a decade and you skip over that bit. Or you develop some reason why you it's not worth paying attention to anymore. And, Christianity and Judaism have done that to a degree that is hard to achieve now in the Muslim world, and it has to be achieved.
Some final thoughts. I keep saying that there's this growing chasm that may continue to grow, and that we always talk about it sort of financially, the haves and the have-nots. But there seems to be a group that seems to be heading toward meditation, toward diet, toward philosophy or stoicism or many of these other disciplines, martial arts, what have you, this very strong, healthy, positive physically in terms of like what your diet is, but also what your exercise is, but also what your regimen is mentally. Again, all the things we kind of talked about. And another portion of our society that's eating more fast food and playing more video games per day and putting weight on and doing all the sort of negative things that you wouldn't want for your kid or society. And I believe that is going to create this chasm. It's not back in the 100 years ago, there was rich guys and poor guys, but they were both skinny and they both sort of believed in God and they both sort of raised their kids the same way. Now we're getting further and further apart. And I don't know if we're just going to keep going or if you've given that any consideration.
Yeah, well, I am worried about wealth inequality, and I have been for some time, and all of the other factors.
Well, this wealth inequality comes along with this as well,
yeah.
Or maybe it perpetuates it, or maybe it leads it.
Both, yeah.
Both, but
yeah, I mean, there's self-perpetuating. I mean, there's all of the cultural norms that begin to get segregated by class, and I mean, it's not a clear line on all of these things, but yeah, it is true. I mean, things have changed. If you look at the wealthiest people in our society now, it's not like an episode of Downton Abbey where you just have the leisured class where they're very idle and they're just everyone's putting on an extra 10 or 20 pounds and it's a sign of how prosperous you are. And wealthy people tend to, for the most part, work longer hours than anyone else now, right? I mean, they're workaholics. They're really into fitness and They're super fixated on the kinds of educational opportunities they give their kids. And, you know, there's a kind of a machinery of advantage that gets turning, and it is across all of these domains. So, I mean, the difference in health between the top 1% and the middle class is enormous, and it's bigger than between the middle class and the poor in this, to speak of the U.S. now. And it's, you know, it's an enormous difference. I mean, it would be analogous to get the middle class up to where the 1% are with respect to health would be an analogous change to curing cancer across the board, right? I mean, it's an enormous difference in health outcomes. So it's, I mean, at a certain point, we need to ask ourselves just how much inequality, you know, again, in every respect, in terms of material resources, in terms of education, in terms of just the discretionary time, health outcomes, all of it, how much inequality we're going to tolerate in the society and what the remedy is once it becomes intolerable. And people who are kind of reflexively against redistribution need to recognize that, you know, there's no guarantee we're not going to wake up in a world where there's, you know, 30% unemployment in this country, and Jeff Bezos is our first trillionaire, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's like, and that just makes no moral sense on some level, even if you are the trillionaire, because what sort of world do you want to live in? I mean, do you actually just want a compound ringed by razor wire and, you know, you want armed guards in the suburban with you as you skulk around the city?
You essentially become Pablo Escobar.
Exactly.
But here's the question. See, I don't believe taking some of Bezos's money and breaking it off or redistributing it is the answer. It's a redistribution of information, or it's a, as someone who comes from that world, I realize I didn't grow up, you know, in the inner city, but I grew up on welfare and food stamps, and I grew up amongst those people, and it's a mentality. It's like the school system isn't great, but the thing that causes more harm than the school system is the culture of not knowing or not discussing or discussing even what achievement is or what education is or what, or you get a job, you fight to keep it, work sucks, and then you die. You know what I mean? Like we discussed survival all the time. We never discussed thriving, you know, almost the same way with the diet you're sort of talking about. It was just like getting fed. We didn't care what we ate. We just wanted to get fed. We're in such a survival mode that we never really got into achievement mode. And somehow that information, which is free, needs to be imparted and shared. And that to me seems like that would go a long way.
Well, I think you need to ask yourself what the end game is in real success. I mean, so take something like the breakthroughs we will ultimately make in artificial intelligence if we play our cards right. If we just keep making progress and we don't derail ourselves with a global nuclear war or a pandemic that knocks us back into some kind of, you know, road warrior hellscape where we can't figure out how to improve our computers anymore. We just keep making progress. We will eventually build machines that are vastly more intelligent than we are, right? And again, this is not assuming Moore's law. It's not assuming any specific rate of progress. It will just eventually happen because there's nothing magical about having a computer made of meat. We can build intelligence into our machines, and we can keep getting better at it. And ultimately, it'll be like chess. I mean, now the best player in the world is a computer, and it will always be a computer, and the computers will get better. And that will be true of basically, you know, you list your top, your favorite modes of human cognition, we'll knock all of those down ultimately. And the consequence of doing that will be to be able to make a kind of intellectual progress and a progress in technology and science that will functionally be just pulling wealth out of the ether, right? I mean, we'll just be pulling it out of the ground. And then the question is what to do with this wealth, right? Now, should all of this wealth accrue to the team at Google that has made this fundamental breakthrough? So you have a few people who are trillionaires, and then we have vast sectors of society where it's not even truck drivers now that are unemployable because we have self-driving trucks. It's software engineers who are unemployable because computers are better engineers, right?
Right.
That's a possible end game for us. And there's some scenario under which this would be nothing but good. It would completely uncouple prosperity from human drudgery, right? Nobody in a world where we're just pulling wealth out of the air, no one should have to work for any reason other than they're doing something they love to do. I mean, there could just be this complete breakthrough into a new ethics of creativity and just a new sense of prosperity where like literally all boats are rising with this tide, this technological tide. And the only thing that would prevent that is our political inability to figure out how to share this wealth, right? So now, obviously, we're not there yet. There's no guarantee we'll get there. We seem impressively capable of screwing things up in the meantime. But if that's the possible path forward, at some point, we need to rethink the ethics and politics of redistribution. And this idea, this sort of Calvinist idea that you know, the only purchase a person has on a right to exist is to find some profitable work they can do that others will pay them for, right? Like that's your place in the world. You figure out something you can do that other people want to pay you for, or you're just going to fall through the cracks and you're going to fall so low that no one's going to be able to see you again. I think progress ultimately, you know, social, political progress, is us recognizing that is untenable for a variety of reasons. I mean, just given how much luck is involved in succeeding, you know, in any way at all in our society. You know, again, you didn't pick your genes, you didn't pick your parents, you didn't author your own intelligence, you know, and you didn't pick even a more superficial thing. It's like you and I can make money by having conversations like this. How lucky is that, right? I mean, it's amazing that this is a job for the two of us, you know, but for the fact that podcasting is a thing, right? But for the fact that you know, this technology made it possible to do this, we'd have to find something else to do, right? And there's no guarantee that, like, you change a few things in society, which again, you and I aren't responsible for. All of a sudden, this whole career path goes away, or it becomes, you know, vastly less lucrative. And we have to pivot to something else. And again, the only tools we would use to pivot are things we've inherited in large measure based on just good luck. So it's like the inequality in luck, you know, the kid who gets a head injury at age 4 and spends the rest of his life dealing with that, right? Or someone who loses their parents before the age of 10, right? And they're dealing with those consequences. I mean, it's just a massive lottery. And so progress as a civilization, I mean, not even just speaking in for the U.S. now, but just as a global civilization, progress has to look more and more like a disposition to cancel the most egregious disparities in luck insofar as we can, right? So it doesn't make a lot of sense that you and I can have a conversation like this and then go about our day if people are starving to death in Westwood. Right. So if there are people starving to death in Westwood, let's figure out how to solve that problem.
Right. That's and then we 9 miles from where I'm sitting.
Yeah. So but the truth is the ethical significance of distance is a bit of an illusion. Right. So it's like starving to death in Westwood would be so galling that you and I would feel a moral imperative to act. But there are people starving to death in Yemen, say, right now.
Yeah. And well, we're sort of
arguably we should feel the same impulse to solve that problem.
Well, we're sort of talking about folks you argue with who argue about equality and women's rights should feel that way about all the countries that are being wildly oppressive to women as well, but they don't have that sense of urgency, obviously.
Yeah. So progress, moral progress on some level is a matter of feeling freer and freer in our attention to feel morally implicated just without respect to distance and without respect to national boundaries and to build more and more creative technical solutions so that it becomes effortless to benefit the people who most need benefiting at any given moment. And I mean, that's the promise of a really mature technological global civilization. I mean, whatever the government apparatus is that rides on top of that, you know, it's amazing. I mean, to take one example, I don't know if you heard if you listen to the New York Times podcast, The Daily, but you know, a couple of weeks ago, they profiled this couple who run a restaurant in Louisiana, and you know, obviously the business has been torpedoed by the pandemic, and it just was a very poignant look at the suffering of this couple who had everything was going great, or as great as it could under the circumstances, and then all of a sudden, they just by sheer bad luck. They happened to be in a business that was just synonymous with failure under the conditions of a pandemic. I mean, if you, no matter how successful you are as a restaurateur, you know, if no one's going to restaurants, you're in free fall.
Right.
And so I found this podcast, you know, very arresting, and I just realized I could make a material difference in these people's lives by just sending them some money. Now that, you know, there are not a lot of norms around doing that, just sending strangers money, but you know, I felt the impulse to do it, and I realized I could reach out to the producers at the Daily podcast, and they pointed me to a GoFundMe page that they vetted, and it felt absolutely great to do that. Now, I think we should take the friction, the moral friction, out of doing things like that more and more, and you know, we'll all feel better in our abundance, because again, it's absurd. This is pure luck that I happen to be in a business. I mean, my main gig at the moment, I mean, I also write books, but my main gig is my podcast and my meditation app. Both of those things are thriving under a condition of absolute economic calamity for most people, right? Based on pure luck. It's not to say that I don't work hard. I do. I'm basically a workaholic. But the fact that I'm in an industry, the fact that I'm not running a restaurant, is pure luck. And so you have to, that should be morally significant to people. I mean, we have a burden to spread the luck around, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. And we'll talk again. And I have many thoughts about luck, and we'll debate them slightly, but sure. I completely agree. And I don't know. I was thinking about I was talking to Dr. Drew about was it Barnhart? Who Barnhart? I'm trying to think of the German theologian. I was just talking about Friedrich Barn. Oh, God, skipping my mind. But anyway, Dr. Drew sent me a quote about
Bonhoeffer?
Bonhoeffer,
Friedrich Bonhoeffer, the Christian.
He was hung 2-3 weeks or hanged 2-3 weeks before Hitler killed himself. You know, that's bad luck. That's bad timing. You know, the war's ending, and one of the last things they're going to do is hang you, you know. Right. And I do think about that stuff. And anyway, I'd like to continue this conversation, Sam. I appreciate you being generous with your time, and I hope you can come back and we can just do an hour on the subject of luck.
Yeah. Well, great to meet you over Zoom.
Yeah, I agree. Making Sense with Sam Harris is the podcast, and the meditation app is called Waking Up. I'll let you go, Sam. I'll take care of a little business here, and we'll pick this up again sooner than later, I hope.
You're great, great. Take care, Adam.
Nice meeting you. First, Tommy John, working from home. Well, yeah, a lot of us are working from home these days. Tommy John knows it's got its ups and its downs, and that's why they got new improved underwear, making it more resilient. It's now 2 times more durable. And right now, for all customers, you get 25% off site-wide upgrade to the softest, most breathable fabrics you've ever worn. No wedgie guarantee, no visible panty lines for the ladies. The loungewear is it's decadent. It's so soft. It's so scrumdilicious. And the loungewear is great, but the underwear is the best. And now that's 2 times more durable. I don't know what your excuse is. They stand behind it 100%. Best pair you'll ever wear. Or it's free. Guarantee. Tommy John, no adjustment needed, right, Dawson?
Hurry to TommyJohn.com/Adam and get 25% off your order. That's TommyJohn.com/Adam for 25% off orders. See site for details.
All right. Nashville Zanies coming up June 12th and June 13th. Stand up there live. Well, I don't know if we're doing a live podcast, but we'll do 2 shows Friday, 2 shows Saturday. We'll figure that out. So tickets available there coming up in on June 12th and 13th. I'm your emotional support animal. Well, pre-order that at Amazon.com and bookmark us and click through and get pre-order that audiobook as well. It's coming out June 16th. And you can go to our YouTube page and see all the stand-up you want until next time. Oh, Ed Calderon coming back again. Knows everything about Mexico. Interesting guy. Until next time, Adam Carolla. For Sam Harris and Gina Grandenball, Brian, say it. Mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Give him a thumbs up on Facebook over there, too. Then pick up the phone and leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And you can watch this broadcast at youtube.com/Adam Carolla. And be sure and pre-order all of it. The new book, the new audiobook. I'm your emotional support animal. All of those links at AdamCarolla.com.